I have a 16-year-old daughter. Some of you met her when I preached here the last time or saw her across the room. From the time that she was a toddler, we had a ritual in March or thereabouts in the year as we anticipated the coming of spring. We live near where Kleber lives, near Tower Grove Park in St. Louis, and we would drive through the park on our way home, and we would look for signs of life. We would note the bright green buds that were new on the tree. We would see the tender growth in the grass, and then among the groves of trees, the tiny sprouts of purple and yellow crocuses just beginning to show their way through the earth. Seeing these signs of life always gave us hope that the cold winter days would soon be over and that the warmth and new life and beauty of flowers would soon be ours with the coming of spring. It was so much fun to intentionally watch new life of spring to grow. Each day we would go by and we could see a difference one day after the next. It was tangible. It was nothing short of amazing. Children's growth is incredible to observe as well, and I know that you know what I'm speaking of. You know how it is when you haven't seen a child for maybe a year or two, and how they look almost like a different person. They are taller, they use their body with more confidence, their faces are taking shape. Sometime when my daughter has been away for even as short a time as a week, I think I can almost see a difference in her. I swear that growth is happening before my very eyes. Do you know what I mean? What is really amazing, though, is seeing the intellectual and the emotional growth of a child. To see and to hear when they finally have grasped a mathematical concept and its application to daily life. To witness them making a mature relational decision. Seeing them begin to have a strong sense of self-worth and to assert it appropriately is so rewarding. You know, there are so many people that are pessimistic about the youth of today. You know how people talk. They'll say, oh, I just don't know what our future will bring. Our youth are so irresponsible. What's our world coming to? Well, I don't know about you, but I disagree with that. I am so impressed with so many of the young people that I know. There certainly are kids out there that have problems and that cause problems, and there certainly are parents that are challenged in that role. But by and large, when I look out at the world of the next generation, I can't help but be impressed and to have hope for what the future will bring. These young people are an example of that. This past year, I served as a mentor with one of the eighth graders at First Church in St. Louis. I loved the time that I had each month with Sarah. Getting to know her as a person, talking about theological concepts, something that I love to do, but you kind of rarely have the opportunity to do that with youth, but that was part of our job, so that was great. Sitting back and listening to her profound and yet very personally relevant affirmation was so rewarding. When we hear our children individually and collectively profess the faith that we have nurtured them in our churches, it gives us incredible pride, and for good reason. Growth physically, emotionally, spiritually, intellectually happens in many different ways. And it doesn't happen just with the children and the youth. It also happens when we are older in life. It's something in reality that's supposed to be a part of all of our lives. My grandmother died when she was 92. It was about 15 years ago. She was an amazing woman. She was a pastor's wife and was very involved in the church, as you would expect. She went to a church that had an active adult education program, and any time there was a class offered, she signed up to take it. Even after her husband, my grandfather, died, or maybe even in some ways more so after he died, when she was well into her 80s, she would write me letters telling me about her daily piano practice and having a new piece of music that she was working on. Or she told me about a course on the Book of Job that she was taking, or having a speaker at the women's gathering on Judaism and what she learned that she had never known before. It wore me out at times just to read all of what she was doing. Granted, she was fortunate to have her health and to be independent almost to her dying day. She was fortunate to have a church that had the resources to have an adult education program. But there was something that was in her spirit that encouraged her to grow and to make the most of her years. She was like those pear trees from the reading that stood in witness to the persistence of lifelong growth that never stopped. All too often, we get set in our ways and take the attitude that this is just how things are to be. We resist growth because we don't want to change. Now, I don't know about you, but I know that I'm that way. In fact, at work, my colleagues tease me whenever there's a new policy or a new something or other that's added to what we're supposed to do, because I can get into a real whiny space about having to change, about doing something new, even if it's supposed to make things better. A few years ago, we went from having paper charts to having electronic charts, and so that meant converting to computers and all that. And oh, you would have thought that I was being asked to have a root canal the way I whined and cried about it. I mean, I remember one night I was so frustrated, I literally was crying at this computer. Ugh. Of course, afterwards, it was not only more efficient, I mean, it was faster for me. It not only enhanced our communications, but it allowed for deeper and more consistent assessment. It enabled us to do our work better. Okay, they were right. Growth isn't all bad, but oftentimes we resist it. There's a woman by the name of Barbara Higbee who has a song called Signs of Life, inspired my title for this morning. I've loved her songs for years, but only as I was writing this did I sit down to read what she was saying. In it, she reflects upon the day-to-day challenges, maintaining the house, exercising, failed relationships. She expresses feelings of simply going round and round and wondering, feeling like she's not getting anywhere. What's all this for? Is this what life is about? In the midst of her questioning meaning in her life, she's looking for signs of life. In the last couple of years, there have been numerous mines in the country that have collapsed and killed miners. I want to recall two such events, one in Sabo, West Virginia, where 11 miners died and one miraculously survived. I don't know if you remember that story. And then the Crandall Canyon in Utah, where 6 miners died after what was speculated to possibly be an earthquake. Imagine what it would be like to be a rescuer, going in looking for signs of life. Imagine listening for taps of metal on metal, or listening for faint voices crying for help. Imagine trying to drill down into air pockets and sending down cameras to look in a type of upside-down telescope for the tiniest type of human movement. Imagine what the rescuers in China and Myanmar province have had to do as they have looked for life amongst the dead in the recent catastrophes there. I'm sure they've seen some pretty gruesome things. I also bet that if they are lucky enough to see signs of life, that it makes all that work possible to keep going. Sometimes we get in our own ways. A few weeks ago, there was a story in Time about surviving a disaster. Again, I don't know if any of you may have seen this. It talks about how when people are traumatized in a disaster, that often they become paralyzed emotionally and can't think well enough to function to save themselves. Told a story of people on a ship in Estonia back in the 90s that ran aground and eventually sank. What was telling was that there were passengers, so this is being told by a man who survived this, and as he was trying to go to where there was air and where he was above water and all that, he saw that there were passengers on the deck who were still alive, there was still air there, but they were so stunned and so traumatized by what they were experiencing that they were still. They couldn't move. They didn't know what to do. They couldn't think enough to problem solve. He said it was like a stupor, and he said that instead of thinking of people as being all in a panic in a situation like that and just kind of running crazy, not knowing what to do, that it's really more common for people in an event like that to just get into that stunned, kind of stuporous state and then to go down with the ship, as was the case here. 850 people died in that horrible disaster. The article goes on to tell the value of drills to train people so that they're not paralyzed like that. Doing fire or other emergency drills over and over again help to put in place routines for people to follow, but more importantly, encourage the brain to keep thinking and to not kind of get into that stuporous kind of state when a disaster strikes. And then they tell a story about a man named Rick Riscorla. Rick was a man with a significant military history. He served in Vietnam and earned numerous medals. He saved numerous people. After the war, he settled into life in the New Jersey area and worked for Morgan Stanley at the World Trade Center as a security person. He knew from firsthand experience the importance of drilling into people's heads responses to disaster. Well, way before 9/11 happened, he worried about there being a disaster at the World Trade Center, way before even 1993 when there was that bombing that happened there that wasn't successful at toppling the buildings. So he was worried about this, and he knew that his job was security of the people. And he tried to get the Port Authority, who I guess were the authority that oversaw the World Trade Center, tried to get them to put in place drills to help the people to better react to potential disasters. But he never got anywhere. They wouldn't listen to him. They thought he was overreacting. But he wasn't to be stopped. He took his job seriously, and he instituted a drill program where he knew that you couldn't necessarily depend on first responders to save you, and that you had to be able to save yourself. Months after months after months, he had surprise drills. So I want to quote the article here. "The radicalism of Rescola's drills cannot be overstated. Remember, Morgan Stanley is an investment bank. Millionaire, high-performance bankers on the 73rd floor did not appreciate the interruption. Each drill, which pulled brokers off their phones and away from their computers, cost the company money. But Rescola did it anyway. His military training had taught him a simple rule of human nature. The best way to get the brain to perform under extreme stress is to repeatedly run it through rehearsals beforehand. After the first few drills, Rescola chastised employees for moving too slowly in the stairwell. He started timing them with a stopwatch, and they got faster. He also lectured his employees about some of the basics of fire emergencies. Because roof rescues are rare and extremely dangerous, people should always go down. On the morning of 9/11, Rescola heard an explosion and saw Tower 1 burning from his office window. A Port Authority official came over the PA system and urged people to stay at their desks. But Rescola grabbed his bullhorn, walkie-talkie, and cell phone and began systematically ordering the Morgan Stanley employees to get out. They performed beautifully. As Rescola stood directing people down the stairwell on the 44th floor, the second plane hit, this time striking about 38 floors above his head. The building lunged violently and some people were thrown to the floor. "Stop," he ordered through the bullhorn. "Be wise, be silent, be calm." In response, no one spoke or moved. He went on to sing to the people, calming songs while they worked their way down the staircases. He had done the same thing in Vietnam. The story continues. Between songs, Rescola called his wife. "Stop crying," he said. "I have to get these people out safely. If something should happen to me, I want you to know I've never been happier. You made my life." Moments later, he had successfully evacuated the vast majority of Morgan Stanley employees. Then he turned around. He was last seen on the 10th floor heading upward, shortly before the tower collapsed. His remains have never been found. Rescola taught Morgan Stanley employees to save themselves. It's a lesson that has become somehow rare and precious. When the tower collapsed, only 13 Morgan Stanley colleagues, including Rescola and four of his security officers, were inside. The other, listen to this number, 2,687 were safe. End quote. Sometimes we are our worst enemies. I read you that story about called falling out of bed. Can you imagine trying to sleep on the edge of bed and falling out? How embarrassing. It's one thing for a child to do that, but an adult? What does it say about someone's ability to relax, and what does it mean to be on the go so much that you have to stay on the edge of life in order to be ready to move? Obviously, the writer offered this story as a metaphor, and I'm offering various metaphors this morning. But it's apropos to consider how often we put ourselves inadvertently at risk in life, because in one way or another, we fall asleep too near the place where we get in. When we are stuck in the same place, in our beds, in our lives, when we resist growth and change, then we set ourselves to be vulnerable, to fall out of bed, or to stay stuck in a building that's going down. It's easy as individuals and even as a church to fall into those same old ruts and to not see any need to grow or change. What are ways that you do that? I know that I have my ways. The author of the reading said, "Who is it that you haven't been willing to reach out to and to learn more about, but instead you get too caught up hearing your own story and what you want to say to them?" Maybe there's somebody that you need to call and make amends with, or just say, "I'm sorry," or just say, "I haven't talked to you in a long time." What books haven't you been willing to read? What articles are waiting for you to take in? What ways as a church has this church been stuck in those ruts? We might not need a Rescorla to drill things into us again and again like a sergeant, but sometimes it requires some discipline. Okay, I'm going to do this, and little by little, over time, we're able to grow. We all, as human beings, have a need to grow, but it doesn't happen as naturally, as automatically, as the little ones in front of us this morning. It's slow, it's harder to see, but it can happen, even to our dying days. So what signs of life are there out there for you? What is inside of you that's yearning to grow and just needs some nurturing, some watering, some sunlight, whatever it may be? The issues in our lives might not be quite the life and death issues as a survivor in an earthquake, a mining collapse, terrorist attack, or even in a flood. But still pushing ourselves to grow, to acknowledge that innate desire to hold on to life and to persist in life as that tree did in life-giving, can change who we are and can change the world around us. Amen.